Does picking an outfit have you running a little too fashionably late? We get it. Great taste takes time. That's why Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery, has your back with the largest selection of beer, wine, and spirits delivered in under 60 minutes. Convenience never goes out of style. So if you need to spend some extra time in the mirror instead of at the store, download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com today.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Hi, everyone. It's Michael Nesmith on the Pantheon Podcast.
Welcome to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, a Pantheon podcast. Look inside the, let the sound take you away. Music.
Girl, we couldn't get much higher.
Culture. Conversation.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me.
And good old-fashioned rock and roll.
Excuse me while I kiss this.
So now, I give you Miss Pamela and her pajama party.
Hello, dolls. This is Miss Pamela's pajama party on Pantheon Podcasts. And here we are again. Gosh, I think this is my 15th or 16th podcast. I'm so thrilled to be able to do this and share my friends with you and music I love and musicians who I think are worthy of some of my fabulous time and your time. And, you know, a lot of people know me as a groupie, and a groupie is just someone who loves music so much they want to be around the creators. And, it, you know, it inspires us. Groupies are inspired by music. Male, female, in between, doesn't matter. It's all about the music and the love of it. Right now, unfortunately, my tours, you know, aren't happening. My rock tours of Hollywood and Laurel Canyon, but as soon as this mess is over, I'm going to be doing those again. And you can read my column at pleasekillme.com. I just wrote one about about my very first live band that turned me on when I was 13. They rehearsed in a garage across the street. They're called the Rainbow Rockers. I just wrote that column. And I hope you listen to all the Pantheon podcasts. We've got some really high ratings, dolls. We are all music all the time. We have like how many now? 30, 40 podcasters? Incredible. So please listen to Pleasant Gaiman. She's a good friend of mine. She has her own podcast now with us. Pretty thrilling. And tell your friends to listen to us because we are cool, okay? You're the cool kid if you're here with us.
Baby, baby, I'm aware of where you go. Each time.
Today's guest is pretty special to me since I was married to him for 14 years. Finally, we have the great, fascinating, the witty, the unique Michael DeBar on the show today. Yay! So glad you're with us. Hang in.
Boy wants to be a girl. You got to serve somebody. You got to serve. Well, hello, Michael DeBar.
Excuse me? Who are you again?
Oh, you know,
we have a similar name.
Wait, I am so thrilled to have Michael DeBar here. It's a, you know, I've wanted him to be on the show for quite some time. Now he has some spectacular, as he would say, thing to promote. So we've got him here. We are lucky ducks today.
Oh, I'm a lucky duck. That's our band name. Let's do an album.
The Lucky Ducks. I like it.
Yeah, the Lucky Ducks. It'd be huge. We cheer everybody up. We cheer everybody up. The Lucky Ducks.
Well, I was feeding ducks yesterday, and they cheered me up.
Really? You know, it's so interesting you say that, because animals are becoming really important during this dreadful thing that we're going through, this dreadful virus that has been treated so ridiculously by our leaders.
Yes.
And my cats have really been very, very comforting.
The
bliss of the animal who doesn't know what's going on.
They don't know.
So look, for that brief moment on your lap, it's not going on for you either. You know?
Look, Daddy.
Oh, look, you're picking up your little...
I was right here.
Look, gosh, that little kitten has grown so much.
I have a new kitten, everyone. His name is Pico.
And Nick loves him.
Tijuana.
Right? Our son adores him.
Yes, Nick just loves this kitten.
That's so great. That's so great. We might, you know, it's so interesting us doing this together, because people will think they're voyeuristically listening to our conversations over the phone.
Well, that
and,
is
and
kind
we don't
of that.
Know. You know what I mean? They've like plugged in. To
yes,
this
here we are. We are.
Private conversation. But that's great. And we will always be connected. There's no way that we wouldn't be.
Yes, we've always stayed connected, even when, you know, we had a breakup like people do. But we always put our son first. So we kept this incredible friendship, which now we are like siblings.
Yes.
We are both only children, and we have an only child.
Yeah, I think the older you get, the bigger your family becomes, if you're open to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I do believe that all of the people that listen to me on the radio are you know, fans. Absolutely not. I would never use that word. I've never used that word anyway. Either intimate strangers or family. It's a family. It's a family. It's a rock and roll family. It's a tribe. I believe we're in a tribe. I you know, and that's the way I look at it. People that enjoy what one does, and people, and indeed people who don't.
Michael has been on Sirius XM, like one of the most important DJs over there on Little Steven's Underground Garage for what, 5-6 years now, Dad?
Seven. It's about 6.5 years that I've been at Little Steven's Underground Garage, Sirius XM, Channel 21. And it's
Channel 21, everybody.
Beautiful place to be. You know, great music, great rock music, great soul music, rockabilly, you name it, all different genres. The key, and I think the authenticity of that music is just that. You know, it's authentic music made by people in a studio.
Yes. Actual instruments being held in
hands. Well, looking at each other, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just like looking at each other. Can you imagine? You know, I have nothing against or negate technology or the way people are making music today at all. I mean, it's fantastic music, but there's something about that the mystery of, you know, you could be in a band, you could be fighting, you could have lost the cocaine somewhere, you could have whatever, you've done something terrible. And but the intimacy of, like, when you're playing music together transcends all pain and all arguments and all rage and anger. Suddenly you're one unit. You know, that's what I loved about being in bands.
Yeah, well, look at Pete and Roger from The Who. Somehow they managed to get on stage together and somehow make it work, even though I don't think they actually speak.
They despise each other.
Yeah,
is the facts. But yes, they make it work. That's not really what I'm talking about. That's the, you know, that's 50 years of making records, and they have come to their own way of doing it. The joy, and I think the reason, you know, that I've lasted this long is because I love being in bands, you know, and I've been in 105 bands now.
You have.
Yeah.
Let's hear some of the names of your bands.
Silverhead was the first band.
Yes.
Which was this mascara.
I was there for that.
Scotty band, which you know very well. And the second one was Detective on Swan Song, signed by Jimmy and Robert, Page and Plant. The third one was Checkered Past with Steve Jones and Nigel Harrison and Clem from Blondie and Steve, of course, from the Pistols and Tony Sales from Bowie's Tin Machine.
That was an incredible band.
Rockin' band, great live, unbelievable record, not so great live, the greatest rock band. But I do believe that every band is capable of being the greatest rock and roll band on any given night. I do believe
totally.
That. I know you do.
Yes, and depending on who's in the audience and who, you know, it's... You can say often that was the best thing I've ever seen in my life. And sometimes there's only a dozen people there with you. It really doesn't matter. It's live music rules, you know.
I know you travel thousands of miles to some obscure, you know, singer-songwriter.
Well,
Todd Springsteen.
Where Dion is. Come on.
No, but you will go to great efforts
yes.
to see you know,
I will drive
artists.
Miles to see Todd Snyder, for instance, or Red.
Yeah.
My favorites.
Or you know. Mike Stinson, you know,
yes, I will.
Brilliant musicians that have not reached the stratosphere. So therefore, you're going to see the music and hear the music and feel
yeah.
the music
yeah.
live. And I mean, I think that that's what it's all about. Live music is everything. You know, that's when you really bond as a band.
I just wrote my column this month about the Rainbow Rockers.
That's great. Your
and they were, I was
incredible.
13. They started playing across the street rehearsing. And that was a life-changing moment, week, month, a few months we hung out. It was like, what? These musicians are breathing across the street. It was, you know, they're alive.
The only breathing I heard was heavy breathing from other boys in the boarding school. That's the only breathing I heard. You know, I wish I'd heard the Rainbow Rockers in the garage next door. Watching her going, hey, Debar, would you go and get my potatoes? Or whatever it is, you know, like we had to do that. We were ordered around by older boys.
Yes. That must not have been fun for you.
Well, it's in the documentary, Who Do You Want Me to Be? Very,
yes.
Know, just talk about that.
That's what we're going to talk about.
The hypocrisy of the British aristocracy.
Michael's documentary features him, of course, mainly. But he has a lot of really fun, interesting characters talking about him and their friendships and etc. I'm in it, of course. Our son Nick is in it. His wife Britta is in it. And all kinds of kind of superstars.
Gabriel Byrne, Steve Jones, John Taylor, Ed Begley Jr., Stephen Van Zandt, of course, my boss, a lot of really great people. I was very, very lucky along the way to be inspired and become friends with people that taught me a great deal.
Yes, but you're a wild thing. I know you get up at 5 a.m. and you do your show and you run and you do all this stuff. Michael is my age. We met on his 26th birthday.
58.
But he's 58. In such incredible shape. And his skin is still beautiful skin. How do you get it from... His skin does not sag, does it, Michael?
Nivea.
It's not really Nivea.
I'm not kidding.
It's genetics.
Well, it could be. I don't know. I never knew him, did I?
You know. Well, Michael's documentary is on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, it's on most streaming platforms. But, you know, the whole thing about, you know, health is you've got to move your body. You have to. I don't care how you do it, but you got to keep moving, especially now because we're confined to the couch and Netflix.
Oh, boy,
so
are we.
You got to get off your ass and out, you know, for at least an hour a day and keep moving. And I would stress that, of course, there are deeper things. There's yoga, there's Pilates, there's all the rest of it. A good diet, drink lots of water and all of that. Don't smoke, don't drink, and just love each other, you know. I mean, that's the ultimate.
Yes, wouldn't it be nice?
Honestly, yeah, yeah.
I actually have had drinks the last two nights because I've been sad about Mercy. So
sure.
I've had some drinks. But
really, what did you drink?
I drink vodka, you know.
Wow.
And how many years? You have 39 years sober? Anyway, Michael's
right,
sober
yeah.
for a very long time. He's
yeah.
inspired so many people and helped
yeah.
so many people get sober.
Well, it's by attraction, isn't it? It's not by promotion.
Yeah.
You
yes.
know, that's really important. I can't say, hey, man, you know, especially when
no,
somebody
doesn't work.
Fight. You know, when I did Live Aid and I joined the Power Station, I remember those boys, they're beautiful, beautiful people, John and Andy Taylor. And they were young, early 20s millionaires, Beatles, Duran Duran. And then we did that band and, our own plane, bowls of Coke. And I never for 1 minute said, fellas, you know, life is so much better without that. You know, what would I'd rather jump out the fucking plane, you know?
Yeah, well, the private jet.
Because you can't do that. Yeah, private jet. you can't do that, you know? But I do, they're both sober now. I do believe that it's just because I had a lot of balls and fun and enjoyed myself, you know?
Yeah, yeah, they saw that. Yeah, you don't need that to be a rock star.
No.
Because a lot of times people believe that lifestyle is part of being a rock star, and it's just
very clever of you to observe. I believe that Keith Richards' habit was more important to a lot of people than the songs they were writing.
Yeah, sure.
They were more inspired by Keith's lifestyle, shall we say, than actually writing a good chorus.
Living vicariously through them. You know, people do that with, but then they decide, gee, maybe I'll do that myself.
Well, you get caught. There's a moment where you get owned. You know, for a little while, it's great, and you have fun with it, and then suddenly you're owned by it, and you need it desperately. You know full well what I'm going through because I put you through it.
Yes. It was not easy.
It was awful. It was despicable and, spiritually criminal to put somebody through that. The problem being, of course, there's nothing one can do about it once you're addicted. And, and also, good Lord, being owned, you know, by something.
Yeah, by something, exactly. But can't
ridiculous.
You be owned by a health kick also?
No, because that's unhealthy. Because you're looking at it as something that you need. It's something that is. You know, there's a big difference, you know, because you get these, I think that's called anorexia.
Yes.
You go too far. You know, the thing is, you embrace
health
and a life of health because it's much cooler. I mean, your skin is better and your love life is better.
Of course, yes.
And it's better. But to be owned by anything, even vegetables, is uncool. So look out, you vegan maniacs. The vegan maniacs, there you go. Everything is vegan.
I know that everything's always a band name.
Everything's a band name, yeah.
Nick and I always come up with band names.
Of course you do. I love doing that with our kid. That's my favorite thing. Yeah.
So tell me about how this documentary came about. And, you know, your life has always, I've always thought it deserved a documentary, a peek into your fascinating existence. So how did it come about?
I was on a show, some TV show, and the producer writer of that show, Josh Weinstein, came up to me and said, look, you've been through a lot. I want to make a film. Can I make a film about you? And he hadn't finished the sentence before I said, yeah. Yeah, I'd love that. You know, he said, there's one condition. I said, what's that? He says, you cannot look over my shoulder during the course of this.
Mm.
And I went, my God, that's ballsy, you know. And I didn't for years. I never looked at a frame, as you know. I never looked at a frame of that movie until he finished it. And then when he finished it and I looked at it, it was a heavy moment in my life.
Tell me how it made you feel to see your life kind of unspool in 90 minutes.
You lucky bastard.
Yeah.
You know, and how grateful I was that I met you and met everybody in my life, you know. For every dreadful place I found myself, you know, being an orphan, which is essentially what I was, and then people become so important, not parental, but somebody you trust. Everything is about trust. Who do I trust? Nobody, in the beginning. And I had to learn. And the people in the movie are just another trust lesson. So I went from class to class to class, you know, from different person, and found out, okay, this person's trustworthy, so I can believe in that. So it's a progression of belief system. Everybody in that movie has taught me something. I have learned more from the mistakes than I have from the triumphs, that's for damn sure.
And isn't that the name of your latest band?
Well, the name of the band, you know, I mean, obviously I have 1,000 projects in my head musically, you know, with the musical that I'm writing about, The Sard with Roger Greenwald, that's of prime importance to me now. But The Mistakes is my rock band that we go out and play, because it's just such a great word. It's such a punky word and such a funny word to me, you know. And it's true. I mean, the best songs I've ever written have been mistakes. I mean, I've come up with a word and 10 minutes later, suddenly there's a song. I mean, everybody says the same thing, whether it be John Lennon or your neighbor. You know, the best things come to you when you're not thinking, when you're not planning, you're feeling.
Oh, totally.
And you write, and like you as a writer, one of the greatest writers in the world, top 10 rock and roll books of all time in every known magazine or any critic have put you in the top 10 of literature, rock and roll literature, and deservedly so.
Thank you.
And you wrote it, I think, from a physical sense, from an emotional sense. You can't, you know, scholastically write a journalistic hook. Like my biggest hook was, who do you want me to be to make you sleep with me?
Yep, you know, which, I know. Right? And you got the great film title out of it. Fantastic title.
Right, because it meant something. It means something, you know. But Jumping Jack Flash is the same thing. The thing about Jumping Jack Flash is, just quickly to actually put this in order metaphysically, is he became Jumping Jack Flash the minute he wrote that song. The minute that song came out, he was mythological. He went from rock star to icon overnight. And by the way, that was the first song that Jimmy Miller, the great Jimmy Miller, produced on that record. That was the first song they did together. And it made Mick Jagger into the Jumping Jack Flash that we know today at 77.
Yes, in 77.
So dig that. So he transcended, I think, from just being a rock star into something way more culturally important with that song. So it's not like it's some clever phrase.
But I'm sure he didn't plan that either. You know,
no.
That's what you're saying. It's
it's not no planned plans. Out. No.
Just, you have to be open. You know how I am. You have to have an open vessel. Dylan says he has no idea where those early songs came from.
Well, I was listening to a lot All Along the Watchtower this morning when I was working out. You know, I have a stationary bike now. That's my new obsession, the stationary bike.
Oh, okay,
which
good.
Is clearly the name of my next band. And we Never Go on Tour is the name of the album. So
we stay in the same place.
So All Along the Watchtower, and I'm going, excuse me? The words in All Along the Watchtower?
Oh, I know. Come on.
I mean, you're going, wait a minute. You know, who could possibly put that stuff together and be so obscure and clear at the same time?
And his new songs on his new album. It's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Anyone else had put that out, some new person right now today, one would stop talking about it.
I mean, the interesting thing about the Dylan where he stands today is, I love it. Somebody said to me, hey, Michael, who's the new Bob Dylan? I said, Bob Dylan. because, you know, I mean,
I love that.
Who's going to buy, you know, he was number one a few weeks ago. He had the number one rock and roll track in the country a few weeks ago.
I know. And it was his first number one. You know how insane that is?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. that's even more fantastic. I didn't even, you know, cotton onto that. But that's how incredibly important he is. But, you know, I mean, everybody's important. You know, Billie Eilish is important. You know, I think if you're open.
What is important to whoever's hearing it and then whatever it does to them. It's the same. That's what groupiedom, of course, is you know, you feel that.
That's right.
You want it yourself.
Yeah. And then when, you know, I have this whole thing about rating. When people say, oh, they were so underrated, so overhead, so underrated, or whatever the band happens to be, or they're overrated. I go, who's doing the rating?
Yeah. Yes, that's
who
right.
is this rater? Where is this? Right? Tell me where he lives or she lives or where they live, and I'll go and, you know, smack him in the head, because it's ridiculous. It's what you love.
Yes,
you know?
It's all so individual, of course.
People are trying to say they love them by saying they're underrated. You know, I love them, but they're underrated.
Yes, that's right.
You know, so I'm not being rude.
I know something you don't know. You know, you're just not with it. You don't get this band, you know, but I do. Yeah, there's a lot of that.
There's a lot of that. And there's a lot of, and it's also a sort of a psychedelic way of describing that you love them and you feel they should be more rated.
Yes, that's true.
I always answer with the people who know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough.
And you connect with those people, you know, like a Springsteen crowd where you and I have been many times together.
Yeah.
The united feeling, it's almost impossible to describe that.
Hey, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Well, it's tribalism. It's like, you know, Martin Luther King. You know, it's the same principle. You've got somebody there saying something that you believe in. But yeah. The addition to rock and roll and the tribalism of rock and roll is music to enhance the communicative efforts. Therefore, the audience is now becomes one. So when that happens, this is a very strange metaphysical thing, you know, where we all are the same. Because I've been saying that for a long time, especially on the air. I say we are all the same. We share the same secrets. I don't believe in fandom or iconic behavior. I think we're all here with the same values, you know. And of course, we're individualized. We have our own tastes. But I mean, we're here as one.
We are one, yeah. I feel that way, of course.
So when Lennon, you know, when they wrote All You Need Is Love, you know, it made so much sense in the 60s. You know, it just made so much sense. But it wasn't time for the world to fall in love with love. And I argue that it might not be right now either.
No, I was just going to say, what about right now? There's more divisiveness out there than ever in my lifetime.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a tremendous amount of division, more so than ever. Our corrupt leaders clearly have mapped that out. Whoever those leaders are, I leave to your imagination, because it's not for me to, you know, espouse the virtues of anybody. It's very clear that we are being divided as a political ploy,
yes.
Whether it by other countries or whatever it is. I'm sure you guys know what time it is on that level. But that and the plague, this dreadful plague that is going over the land, all over the world.
All over the world. No one's exempt. And of course, that should make us bring us together. It should make us think, wow, if that person across the road, no matter what color they are, how old they are, they can get that thing just like I can. You think it would be a uniting force, but
very good point. Beautiful point. And I absolutely concur with it. It's but it is being used politically.
Oh yeah.
You know, so that is probably the peak of cruelty.
Yeah, it is. I agree with that. But let's go somewhere else now. Let's talk about the day we met.
Sure. New York City. New for me, you know. I just landed in America, I believe, at that time, a country I was completely in love with, which makes sense when I get to you, because there was a movie that you were starring in, and Keith Moon had been employed to play a rock star in this movie. Keith Moon jumped out of the window of a hotel holding a TV and was unavailable.
He was unavailable. I was seeing him at the time. He was one of my beaus.
Yeah.
And he didn't show up.
He did not show up, which is not unusual for Keith Moon. And then my agent was contacted. So I think I belong to some big promoting agency, and the people that were making your movie said, is there anybody
rock star in town who can act?
Yeah, and yeah. God forbid they chose me. And of course, I'd been up for 3 days and nights, you know.
Yep.
And arrive on the set, see you from behind, which is my favorite word. And
I had shorts on that Betsy Johnson
Betty
actually
Grable.
Made for me.
It was like a swimsuit. It was a Betty Grable swimsuit.
It looked like it, but it was shorts.
It was shorts, yeah. And you had your back to me, and I staggered on there, weighing 19 pounds or whatever. And
with a Silver LeMay jumpsuit?
Yes.
Silver. And girls' flats.
And flat, like Cabizio's kind of. No, they were actually girls' shoes.
They were girls' shoes, yeah.
Mark Bolan used to wear.
Yeah, they had little straps on them.
Yeah, white shoes.
White shoes.
Scuffed.
Yes.
You know, they had to be scuffed. If you're going to wear women's shoes, ladies and gentlemen, wear scuffed white women's shoes, you know.
I think those were the same shoes that week we were walking down the street. We were getting to know each other. And the heel popped off of one of them. And you just took off your shoes, or the lady's shoes.
Yeah,
we hadn't seen those shoes since.
Well, and, no, you know what? They were red velvet high-heeled shoes.
Oh, those. Okay, those were a different pair. All right.
And this is a few days after we met, you know.
Yes.
And I remember walking, and I never carried money. I had no money. You had the money. I had no money because it would ruin the line of my jumpsuit.
I know. No change. Oh, God, no.
No, hell no.
You threw the change out in the street.
The change. Yes.
You know, that's still a thing that Nick really enjoys, our son, who we talk about that sometimes, how his dad never carried change around because it made a lump in his skin-tight trousers, and he would just throw it away, no matter how much it was. If there were many, many quarters involved, they would go into the street.
That's stupid, you know. And that's just the one version of how stupid I was in those days. But it was, you know, it was weird. I mean, I'd never had to deal with money, you know, ever really, because I came out of drama school and went right into, you know, acting and making money. But anyway, back to our thing. So we walk on the set and there you are, and I fell in love, and I've been married to somebody else 3 weeks prior.
And she is in your documentary, kindly.
She certainly is. Certainly is, which is fantastic when you think about it.
It is fantastic. All three of your wives are in your documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, Britta and I are very close. I just love her so much.
Yeah, she loves you so much. And it's a fantastic feeling, you know, it really is, because everybody knows everything. See, the thing is, secrets suck.
Yeah.
Because you have to remember them. And I'm getting, you know, and I think the older you get, the less you remember. So
and
secrets,
you know,
can be,
you know. When you think a secret's about to be revealed, the feeling inside, the panicky, there's nothing like it, you know. No. So you do anything to avoid that.
Yeah, I think it actually makes your life shorter. So all of you egomaniacal liars, stop doing that, because you'll live longer.
You'll live longer if you stop, absolutely.
Yeah, you know.
So that movie was so funny because, of course, you were the best thing in it. You and Ted Danson.
Yeah.
You know, I saw Ted recently at Ed Begley's, and we were talking about that movie. And that was his first role ever.
Can you imagine
being in that shitty, God bless Chuck Wine, but that horrible film, be your first ever performance?
Yeah, but he was lucky because he met you. And he met
he met you too.
Yeah, and Cheers.
And he's such a good guy.
Cheers.
Cheers. You know, I saw him in Dr. Bleckman's office too. That's his doctor.
Wow. No, he's an icon. It's, you know, obviously amazing character, and he's done so beautifully and so well and done such, you know, great work. But that was a magic vibe, wasn't it?
I mean, he was in the party scene.
I know. I remember distinctly, you know. But there I was, and I always say, whenever I'm asked about how we met, that it was a moment when I fell in love with you immediately for many, many reasons. You're the sexiest girl in the world. But really, to me, you represented America.
Yeah.
And I wanted a relationship with this beautiful country of ours. And I literally had a relationship and have a relationship with the person that I think was the Statue of Liberty in a short dress.
Aw, that's sweet. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's because you are so intrinsically American. You know, your daddy was a miner. Come on.
Yeah, he was a
Kentucky
beer bottling gold miner, my daddy.
You know, so, you know, a beer drinking, fabulous guy, and who I adored, you know, got along really well with, which is ridiculous because I was Marlene Dietrich,
you know,
compared to, you know, your dad.
First time he showed up to meet my mother, he showed up at our door in the valley. And he had two bottles of Jack Daniels in each pocket and that silver lamé jumpsuit zipped all the way down with rats all in his hair. And my mom took me into the kitchen and said, "You're not serious about this one, are you?" I'll never forget that line. It was so awesome. And I said, "Actually, yes, I am." But of course, both my parents came to just love you so much.
Oh no, it was great. I mean, for me, you know, I led such a ridiculous life of like no rules, you know, at all. The free, liberated life. And can you imagine the mid-60s in London? I mean, please, it was, you know, the sidewalks were made of velvet, you know, cobblestones, polka dots, Jimmy. You know, I mean, the Beatles.
And the music, oh my Lord.
Peter Green, you know, I mean, actually seeing Peter Green when I was 16, which is not a poem, but it will be. You know, there he was, man, you know, and it was an amazing time. So to come to the States and then meet you, that epitomized a certain America to me, and then come out to California and meet with your gold digging, you know, gold minering father and your beautiful, you know, trusting, smart mother was absolutely another.
Well, yeah, because your upbringing was quite the opposite. I had like this idyllic upbringing. Michael's mother and dad were about as far away from OC and Margaret that, I mean, it's impossible to describe it.
And each other.
And each other. Yeah. Michael's mom said to Michael one time, I hope you don't mind me revealing this.
No.
That the only time she made love with your dad, you were conceived.
Yeah. That's, I mean, it. That's, yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
Well, it's biblical, isn't it? I mean,
yes,
I feel like Moses or something. You know what I mean? I feel like there should be Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Michael.
Yes, it should be.
The new band.
Oh my Lord.
No, it was amazing. And then they doused me in rose water. And by the way, illegitimate.
Yes, illegitimate.
When people then used to call married. People used to call me a bastard. I'd go,
Yes.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
But you had to make up a family when you were in that fancy school. He went to a fancy boarding school, which was paid for by an estate of that his father had squandered already, but somehow the money was always there in that school for you.
So yeah.
Repton, which is this incredibly highfalutin school, and his mom was a dancer, right? Was she?
She was a working girl who had frilly dresses and
yeah, she was a wild thing. And Mike and his dad was a debauched marquis.
Michael debauched.
Michael debauched.
Yeah. Crazy.
So anyway, so when you came to America, it was very different. Very different situation, family-wise.
I really felt that I'd come home because everything to me was like fresh in London at that time. You know, we were eating tons of hashish and everything was very like psychedelic and it wasn't real, you know, because we had this money and I was working all the time as an actor. And that's an unreal situation to be in. When I came to America, it got real for me because this was a young country filled with wildness and experimentation. And, you know, the 60s, and I just fell in love with the whole thing, especially California.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't a Lou Reed guy. You know, I felt more like Janis Joplin.
Yes.
You
know what I mean? Of course.
Lou did wear boas from time to time, obviously. Lou.
Oh, my God. You were always dressed up. And, you know, Michael also, by the way, he was a child actor. So when he arrived and had done all these amazing plays and theater and so when he showed up the day that Keith Moon didn't show up, he almost took over the movie. It's called Arizona Slim. It was never released, even though we did have a fabulous premiere. but he was the best thing in it by far.
Oh please,
you know you were.
Yeah. Well,
your son,
you know,
still makes fun of my performance.
No, well, you don't have to do too much. You just have to be, exist, you know. That's stardom enough for me, and for many others, obviously, you know. I mean, what is remarkable, I think, about you is many things, but certainly your credibility, your people understanding who you are, what you did, and what your work is, has increased a millionfold because your role, your rock and roll role, is feminism. And that's
pure
and simple. You gave girls and women the opportunity and the injection of love and power to go off and do what they really wanted to do, which was become intimately aware of creative artists. What,
right.
a, why that was condemned by Gloria Steinem. As you know, I have my thing about Gloria Steinem. I know there's a movie about her, so what? For me, she was a Playboy bunny who accused you of being a whore.
Yeah.
This is not cool. This is a woman who is going against women to project.
Yes, I know.
Feminism is the feminism. You know, this really pissed me off. As you know, I wrote her a letter.
I know. You wrote a letter, right?
And said, fuck
you. They're often
you.
Published in papers.
Yeah, it was published all over the place because it was a testament as to you are determining what feminism is while you're criticizing somebody who's doing what they want to do. Freedom.
Yeah, I always
America.
Say, you know, that's feminism is a woman doing what she wants to do.
Exactly.
And that's it.
And I hope you enjoyed your days as a bunny.
Yeah. Nothing's wrong with that either.
No.
If that's what you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, serve drinks. Well, God bless her. Great shades. I mean, I loved her shades. Don't get me wrong. She was completely obnoxious.
She should have mellowed by now.
I'm sure she has. I hope she's listening to this because that's the only stumble that she had in a career of really charitable work.
Very important career, very important to feminists, you know. And, you know, at the time when I was popping the birth control pill on the Sunset Strip in front of everyone, that was my statement of owning myself. You know, it was a similar thing.
Yeah, that's huge. People don't understand how important that was at that time. Well, people, I say people.
Yes, many people do understand.
Many people do.
Yeah.
But yes, it's just another act of being an individual and equality. You know, I mean, the fact that you had to fight to be a woman, you know, I mean, imagine what it's like for our black brothers and sisters, brothers and sisters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We can't imagine it.
Equality and justice and compassion and kindness and coolness and courage, you know, is what we're about.
Yep. Unless we're in that color of skin, we don't know. We just have to be supportive as possible.
Well, yeah. I mean, I see the thing about being a DJ on the radio and I'm playing Sam Cooke and I'm playing, you know, the Temptations and I'm playing Janis and I'm playing, you know, the Stones and I play new bands, you know, gay bands, transgender bands. I don't care. I care about the song.
The music. You know, Same here.
And that is really all that matters is who are you? What are you giving? Right now, we have to give everything we've got. I don't care if you're who you are and what sex you are. I don't believe in any of that. I'm violently opposed. Not violently. I'm silent. No, not silently. I'm opposed to anything that isn't free. People should be free.
Yes, and they have to be free within themselves first, which that's why we're here, to figure that out.
Free quality.
Yeah, free quality. Okay, let's go back to the movie a little bit.
Yeah,
because and I were filmed. We went off script in the back of a limousine and started talking about our heroes, right?
Yes.
And we discovered we had three of the same heroes, which
okay,
were...
Let's number them together, right?
Okay.
Elvis.
Krishnamurti.
Elvis comes before Krishnamurti.
Okay, Elvis. Elvis. James Dean and Krishnamurti. All three of those. We talked about those people in the backseat of a limo.
I know, in the middle of a scene of making a movie. Yeah,
I know. and he kept it in.
Yeah, he did. I think drugs were involved.
Yes, they were. In fact,
I think
I was doing cocaine, which is unusual.
Very unusual for you.
I'm not an addictive personality, but I was doing cocaine that day, and I was chewing my mouth off. And I don't know, Michael somehow he found one of the grip girls or something and sweet talked her into giving him some downers.
Yeah. That's
poor
that's
me.
That's what went down.
And I remember her.
It went down with a mug of Southern Comfort, as I recall.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was a really fun film, and we got to know a lot about each other during that.
We sure did. Well, I was already in love, you know, and then we go to L.A. and Silverado playing the whiskey, and you're going out with like three cowboys.
Yes, I was seeing two different, well, actually three. I was seeing Lane Cardell, who was a cowboy. I was seeing Waylon Jennings and Keith Moon. These were the people I was dating.
Just spectacular. I mean, there's a movie right there.
I met Michael, and I had to tell each of them that I was engaged. Michael proposed to me the day we met, even though we'd been married 3 weeks to someone else.
That is correct.
A whole other story. But
and I've made amends, ladies and gentlemen. Are you?
Yes, he's made amends. He's made amends to everyone. But anyway, I had to say goodbye to these people. And, you know, Keith Moon was the one who was the most upset. I never heard from him again. He was really devastated.
Yeah, God bless him.
Because I could soothe him. I have a soothing power.
Yes.
I don't know what it is. I probably got it from my mother because she's incredibly calming presence.
It's so seductive and motherly at the same time. I mean, that is a hell of a combination, you know, in a woman and a young woman. How old were you, 22?
No, it was your 26th birthday and I was 25.
Let's take a few years off that. So
okay,
it
let's
sounds
take
better.
Yeah, let's take three or four off. Okay, you were 23 and I was 22. How's that?
Perfect. That's perfect.
Okay. We would have missed Beatlemania though.
And now we're 40. It's just so exciting.
Oh, I always say I hope I go before you. I just can't imagine being, you know,
oh,
on the planet without you.
Yeah, we're here forever. You know, it's because we've taken so many vitamins.
Oh, yeah, we take a lot of vitamins now instead of drugs.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you know, the vitamins are the new drugs, you know, for our tribe anyway. But, you know, L.A., introduced to L.A., Miss Pella by my side, unbelievable, whiskey,
yeah,
a go-go tiger. I had the tiger there. You remember on stage?
He had a live tiger on stage and the... Right in the middle of a song, the tiger decided to take a poop.
Yeah.
And Michael grabbed a flower out of some girl's hat in the audience and stuck it in the poop.
I did do that. That's called art.
It's called art.
Yes.
It's true. It was
it's called
stuff
art.
Like that, you know. Yeah. No one can even imagine that, even in film. Although in your documentary, there is an image of you with the tiger.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I had it for. I then did a gig with the Dolls. Do you remember? I did a gig with the New York Dolls at Santa Monica Civic.
Yes, I do remember.
In Los Angeles, and I had the tiger with me. Thing about the tiger was, it was on more drugs than me, and that's a lot.
Yes, I know.
It was very
knocked out.
No, and I didn't know any about anything. How those guys? Because there was a guy that looked after the tiger. The tiger was a superstar. The tiger was the star of a TV show called Daktari.
Oh,
and there was a show about a lion thing like Melanie had, you know, like Melanie Griffith had with Tippi Hedren, you know. They had farm of animals. And this was a similar thing, but this was a TV series about these animals. And that's how I found the tiger outside the hotel, the Continental Hyatt, the notorious Continental Hyatt.
Really? Oh, that's
was in it was
that's
in
taking a, advantage of the moment, Michael.
Oh yeah, there was a tiger in the back of a funeral thing, funeral car, whatever you would call
hearse.
It. Hearse. Yeah, hearse. And the hearse was covered in flames, and I looked at, and we just arrived. I just got out the limo and we were in the hotel and I looked in the window and there was a tiger in the back of the fucking hearse. And there was a guy in the driving seat dressed like Stuart Granger in some African safari movie, you know, with the hat, with the tiger skin thing on the hat.
Yes.
And I went, excuse me, can I hire your tiger for a week?
I'm sure you did.
And he said, how much? I said, I don't know, $500? And then point at the roadie, give him $500. And we took the tiger up into the hotel room, which proves the point that you often make, which was there's no security. There was no security.
Oh, yeah.
You could go backstage.
So different.
We took the tiger up. This is the whole band, and collectively Silverhead weighed 150 pounds.
Yes.
Which is what the dog collar and the fucking tiger were.
A lot of it was makeup.
And it was, yes. Yeah, a lot of it was foundation. And then we get up into the hotel and then, you know, just dragged it around for a week. And it was such a, and I loved that tiger. I loved it. I used to sleep on the end of the bed, you know. Nobody else slept. The tiger slept.
Yes.
You know, God knows what the tiger, it must have been traumatized by what it saw. But, you know.
It was around that time, too, that I was seeing Lane Caudill and somehow you got his phone number. I guess it was from Michelle Meyer, right?
Yeah.
And you called Lane Caudill
to
talk to me. And he handed me the phone. He said, some British guy. And it was like, oh my God.
Yes.
And you said you were standing on the Hyatt House roof.
Yes.
And unless I came over there, you were going to jump.
Yes. That is correct. That's exactly what I did. Called your boyfriend and said, if she doesn't come see me, I'm dead.
Yeah, he's going to jump off the roof. But it didn't happen. I did go see him.
Yeah.
And we got involved.
But I always used to say, you went
from goodbye to the others.
You went from cowboy boots to platform boots.
Yes, I did go from cowboy boots to platform boots.
Fabulous. Absolutely. And you know, he was a very sweet geezer. I mean, he was one of those quiet, beautiful American, you know, singer-songwriters.
He was really good too, and I lost track of Lane. I don't know. Lane Caudell, if you're out there, please look me up.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he was a real charmer.
He was a good geezer.
Waylon too. Waylon was married though to Jesse Coulter, so he was cool about.
That's always a problem.
Not seeing me anymore. I didn't know this. Because you know, in those days, Michael.
No, I'm.
No one knew if anyone was married. No one could look anyone up. There was no Googling.
Well, there
people.
Was some unwritten law that when you went on the road, you weren't married. You
know, this sort is
disgusting,
of was that law.
Misogynistic.
Some people understood it, and some didn't. And you know, we could accept it, but we didn't like it. You know, the wives or the girlfriends.
Yeah. Now, of course, it's absolutely ridiculous to even
assume. Well, it can't happen now. You know, it was an era. You know, we talk about Laurie Maddox and some of the young girls who were around the bands then, and oh my God, they're getting so much grief now. But it's hard to explain the difference in what life was like back then.
Well, just read your books, you know, and they get the explanation. You don't have to give anybody an explanation of the way you lived.
No, I was of age too. I was of age.
It was fun. We had so much fun, and you know, in America, and we went around the country, didn't we? Didn't we go like to Atlanta? You came.
I remember we found pubic hairs in the sink of our motel. I remember
which
that.
Is the title of your next book, which is very exciting.
Pubic hairs
in the sink.
Pubic hairs, and I had to remember I couldn't get a ticket home. I was stuck in Atlanta. Ben Edmonds, our friend from
Cream
magazine.
Lent us the
decided
money.
Decided to. He says, "Is there anything you can sell me?" And I said, "Well, Mick Jagger gave me this outfit he wore in performance." He said, "Oh, great! Send me that, and we'll auction it off. And I'll give you the money for the ticket." So he sent me a ticket.
I've forgotten all about that.
That's pretty amazing.
Because we were just some punky band on the road in Mascara, you know, rocking and rolling. Yes. We playing these clubs.
I remember it so vividly. Silverhead was such a great band.
Yeah, it was fantastic. My favorite.
I won't say underrated.
No. That would be terrible.
Because there are many, many people who adore Silverhead, and people like David Lee Roth who totally copied your image and your movements and everything else.
I always say that I'd never address that. I think David Lee Roth is fantastic.
David Lee Roth is fantastic, but I do believe he got a lot from you.
Yeah, I think we all learn from each other, you know.
Yes, I really do. I'm not being political.
I'm attempting not to be political because I know that I think the one guy that had the most impression on me was Terry Reid. Just singing vocally, Terry Reid seemed to me to be the best guy. If you're not familiar with Terry Reid,
was the best singer. It's funny, he called me today. I do believe his wife called and said he wants to talk to me about Mercy. I think he's just trying to be nice.
I'm sure.
He's a sweetheart.
But he was
18 when I met him.
Well, he was 15 when I met him, so there. And I met him in London. in a club, and he's a year or two older than me, and I was 16, and he was playing a Les Paul through a Marshall stack, and he had a purple satin shirt on and white jeans.
Wow, you remember so vividly.
And I couldn't believe this guy.
No,
this guy for you guys out there was the chap that Jimmy Page wanted to sing in Led Zeppelin.
Yes, he was his first pick.
And because he was a guitar player and a singer in his own power trio at the time and very, very experimental, his music was not the normal bluesy-based Rolling Stonesy stuff. It was very, very, I think, more American-oriented than British rock and roll, and he just didn't want to do that. He wanted to play guitar and be himself, and he said, but he said, hey, Jimmy, I've got this guy, his name's Robert Plant, he's really good, you should try him.
Yeah.
And that's what went down.
Yep. And Terry moved to California, and now he lives in Palm Desert.
Yeah.
And I see him every once in a while. He still performs, but man, his voice.
I forgot about it.
His version of Waterloo Sunset by the Kinks is one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
It really is. And even doing when he did Bang Bang.
Bang Bang. Oh, my God. What?
Yeah.
What a version of Bang Bang. Anybody, you guys all listening out here, you're lucky you're hearing this conversation between Michael and I. Go check out Terry Reid.
Yeah, because, I mean, that music is something. I mean, I'm very into covers and interpreting songs, reinterpreting songs. I've been doing it a lot for Steve Van Zandt's label, Wicked Cool. He signed me to his label, and I've been done Stop in the Name of Love from the Supremes, but we did it like Vanilla Fudge, very tough, you know, very hard.
We want to play some of these on the show. Which songs would you like us to...
Stop in the Name of Love, for one thing.
Stop in the Name of Love.
Also, since we spoke about Dylan, you could play Serve Somebody.
Absolutely.
Which is a great version of it. And of course, I love doing cover songs. I really do. And the song that I wrote...
What's Going On, too, is pretty great.
What's Going On, I did. Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. But the song that I really am proud of this year is the duet that I did with the great Genya Raven, which is called Where Did All the Lovers Go, which is a very 60s soul duet, you know.
And you wrote it.
I did. And it's sort of very inspired by Stephen Van Zandt's love of soul music, which then got me deeply involved in soul music. And it's an homage to the great duets, Tammy and Marvin, you know, and all of those wonderful duets.
Yes.
And you guys check it out. Maybe we can play it here. Where Did All the Lovers Go? You know.
Yeah, we'll play it.
I also covered Anarchy in the UK.
My gosh, it's such an amazing version. We've got to hear some of that.
Yeah, and that was very interesting because I love the Sex Pistols. They changed my way of thinking in terms of music when I saw them in San Francisco, the final gig, though it was...
You actually saw them.
I did, yeah, as you know.
People say they saw them, but you actually did.
Yeah. And Steve and Paul were in the same hotel. And coming down the corridor, Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols and Paul Cook, the drummer of the Sex Pistols, were walking towards me. And the first thing Jones did, goes, yeah, I used to steal Silver Ed records. And of course, I fell in love with him right there. You know?
Yeah, Steve became a family member. He was our roommate for quite some time.
Yep.
I have photos of him showing Nick when he was like in his little PJs at 5.
How to play guitar.
Chords, yeah.
Yeah. No, I love Steve Jones. Steve Jones is a magnificent human being and one of the smartest people I ever knew.
Yeah.
and still remains that.
So, speaks the truth, way. Too. He doesn't know how not.
He wouldn't know how to, you know, lie. It wouldn't even begin to enter his head.
Now, I'd also like to play, you know, a Silverhead cut. So tell us which one of those, what, Rolling With My Baby or Hello New York or what?
I think the key song that it seems to be historically is 16 and Savaged.
Yes, 16
because,
and Savaged.
Because, you know, it was the title of the second album. It was after our experiences in America, which I'd fallen in love with, but I saw what was happening to the youngins and how that they were being abused, you know, and that the culture itself didn't even understand or care about teenagers.
Yeah.
You're either a kid or you're an adult. But it became very clear to me that through rock and roll music, young teenagers could become people. And then I saw, wait a minute, Hollywood, you know, is taking advantage. And these girls think they have to wear fishnets and all this. So, you know, I mean, this is all after I've already exposed myself to that world, if you'll pardon the pun.
You
know, but 16 and Savaged is really anthemic in terms of the times. It's based around the Sunset Strip, and there was blood all over it, man.
Okay, let's hear that. Yep. That was the 70s. It was definitely not the 60s in Hollywood. Wow.
Difference in drugs, I think.
Oh, yeah. Difference in drugs. It went from pot and psychedelics to coke and heroin. And,
right.
Yeah.
Things got psychotic. Things got real. You know, on a really addiction level. And I thought, whoa, no, you know. But it took me a little while to suss it out, you know.
I remember that day you went to that first meeting, and that was like a life-changing day.
It was June 19th of 1981. Yep. Not that I remember.
I know. Our little boy was almost three.
Yeah. It was amazing. Shockingly cool, you know.
It was.
But the whole journey for both of us has been amazing. You've become this, you know, global superstar in terms of literature, 5 books, you know, and I know that you're working on 2 more that are mind-blowing. I don't know if you can talk about it.
Yeah, I can't talk about.
Yeah.
One of them I can't talk about yet, but I am writing a third memoir, Sex, God, and Rock and Roll, about my spiritual life, which has coincided from I was born again at 8 years old and all the way up to like yesterday when I was praying to Mercy. I was asking Mercy, how you doing, honey? You know, I mean, it's my spiritual quest in my spiritual life.
It's a great subject. And people will go crazy when they, you know, have the opportunity to be able to feel that way, you know?
Yes, to say,
spirituality,
oh, okay.
You know, your form of spirituality is a rock and roll spirituality. It's not got this sacredness to it. It's how one should live. Like, you took me to see Krishnamurti in Ojai.
Yes, several times.
I'd be loaded on heroin and going, you know what, this guy's really cool. You know, I mean, it's just so insanely interesting, you know, that I remember sitting and listening.
Under the huge oak, yeah.
Being the moment now, this is the only moment that we have is right now. You know.
Yeah, and how frustrated he'd get. Are you getting this? Are you hitting this? It was so amazing to be in the presence of that.
Yeah, and he would get just so frustrated, as you said, and it was so interesting, and one would be so high for like the next hour.
you floated away.
Floating
I got
away.
That. I got it.
And then an hour later, you're in Hollywood and you're going, oh God, what a life.
Speaking of another great experience we shared was seeing Elvis.
Yeah.
Actually, I had seen him once before, but.
With Zeppelin.
We went to Vegas.
Yeah.
It was so cute. We were so innocent, really, because, you know, they put us way in the back, the Hilton Hotel.
Not for long.
And we sat there across from each other and said, I wonder if we gave him a tip if we could move down a little. And so Hugh handed him $20 and he put us halfway down.
Yeah.
And you said, I should have given him 50. We would have been on the stage.
Yeah, sitting next to the drummer. Ronnie Tutt, I think was his name.
But what a thrill to see him.
It was insane because both of us were enslaved by Elvis.
By Elvis from day one.
I mean, that was the first guy. I saw this guy. It was Jailhouse Rock era. 60, I don't know what it would be.
59, 58.
Yes.
Yeah. Kids.
So then I went, no, please. I want that. I want to do that.
Same here. I want that. I said, I want that too.
Yeah, you wanted that in one way. I wanted to sing like that. But and move like that. Or even not even those things, but just be like that.
Just be like that.
Be like that. Be that free and that liberated and that rocking, you know. And then later, of course, one did one's schoolwork on why Elvis became Elvis. But it was an amazing thing that we both connected so hardcore back of that limo in New York in that movie that we did together, and then to go to Vegas on our honeymoon to see Elvis.
Yes, it was so incredible. And we actually saw his last performance in Vegas. That was his last night in Vegas.
I mean, James Burton was in the lobby, as you recall, the guitar player.
Oh yeah. What a memory you have.
Yeah. Well, James Burton is everything. You know, I mean, he was
what a band.
Ridiculous. Ronnie Tutt, was that the drummer? I can't remember.
And he never lost his voice.
Oh, no.
He never lost his voice.
What was your favorite song that he sang?
Treat Me Nice.
Right.
It's my favorite song.
At that gig.
Oh, that gig. Oh, I don't know. One of his big, giant.
I know what it was. It was Mickey Newbury's American Trilogy.
Oh, the American Trilogy, right.
Yeah.
And he would also come out to that music.
Yeah.
The sound of that.
No, he came out to C.C. Rider.
Oh, God, Michael's memory is getting a little sharper than mine. Uh-oh.
Yeah, it came out
to C.C.
Rider.
I better take my jellyfish supplement.
Yeah. But, you know, because his voice, even though he was, I remember when he walked on stage and he was in the white jumpsuit and the cape, and it was so shocking to see him that big, how big he was, you know, how massive he looked.
Yes, but and, he sang.
And within 5 minutes, all you heard was the voice.
I know.
Because his voice never failed him.
Never failed him.
If you listen to watch the YouTube videos of him in the final days, he, you know, obviously looks like he's in really, really bad shape. The voice, however, was as clear as a bell
the day
he died.
Love him so. I just saw what time it is. We've been gabbing for an hour. I do want to play a snippet of the song that you got the title of your movie from.
Obsession.
Yeah. Michael wrote Obsession with our friend Holly Knight, and it has really brought him a whole lot of money through the years.
Filled the coffers, darling.
Yes. But the line, who do you want me to be, was so perfect for, you'll see when you watch the documentary, who do you want me to be, the Michael DeBar story, and he has 127 5-star reviews. So I,
140
probably more by now.
Today. 140.
As 104 today. Wow.
Five stars.
Such an incredible piece. Please watch it.
Yeah.
Because you'll fall in love with him just like I did.
Oh, what a beautiful thing to say.
And it is just wonderful. And you're the greatest, Michael. And, you know, so we're going to hear a little, we're going to say goodbye to you on the wave of Obsession. How's that?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Thank you. Mwah.
You are an obsession. I cannot sleep. I am a possession. Open at your feet. There is no balance, no equality. Be still.
How was that? I don't think there's anyone more charming on this earth than Michael DeBar. He must have, we've talked about his IQ for, since 1974 when we met on his birthday, because it must be huge. Just the words he uses, fantastic. You know, I've been pretty sad lately because I lost one of my dearest friends, and I just want to remind you, Dolls, to listen to Miss Mercy's podcasts, the ones I did two with her. That's how scintillating she is. Was, unfortunately. Mercy passed away a week ago, and I will miss her. You know, she's like part of myself. We met in 69, 68, actually. So I sure am going to miss her, and I love her so much. And thanks for tuning in, Dolls, and I will see you soon.
Listening to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, produced by Aaron Alden and Christian Swain. All sound design by Jerry Danielson and Busy Signal Studios. Find Miss Pamela at Pamela DeBar on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Find all the Pantheon podcasts at pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you find great podcasts. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/pantheonpodcasts. Rock and Roll Archaeology on Instagram and Pantheon Pods on Twitter.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only. Right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.